home of the stars, through the airwaves and on the big screen. Live from Hollywood, it's Rated LGBT Radio with your hosts, Garrett Miller and Rob Watson.
Good evening. It is Rob Watson, your host of Rated LGBT Radio. My co-host Garrett is out and about tonight, although we may play a little Garrett before the end of the hour because Garrett's album, Blonde Jesus, has this incredible Christmas song. I know, too early for Christmas, but it has this incredible Christmas song on it. So we may give you a little preview of that song because, I mean, let's face it, who isn't out buying their next Christmas carols now, this week before Thanksgiving? I mean, got to be ready, right? Because the minute Thanksgiving's over, out come the Christmas carols. But that is not why I have you gathered here tonight, my dear friends. Tonight, we are going to talk to author Jason Leclerc. I've had the pleasure, actually, of interviewing Jason previously. Actually, it's an interesting previously. Jason has a little bit of political columnist background, and we actually talked the week before the election. And here we are a week and a half after the election, and oh, so much has changed. So we may reminisce a little about the good old days, that one week prior when we were naively thinking things might actually go our way, and the reality of it now. But we are going to be talking about Jason's book, The Black Kettle. And it's a very interesting book. We talked about it on Out in Santa Cruz about a week and a half ago, or I guess 2 weeks ago, and got into a lot of elements there. Just a warning, we may have some heads up on different plot twists. So if you don't want to hear those, well, I'm not quite sure what you're going to do. But anyway, we may talk about that stuff. But there are lots of elements in this book that are very pertinent and intriguing. So without further ado, let me bring on Jason Leclerc. Jason, good evening.
Good evening. Good evening.
Welcome to Rated LGBT Radio.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks.
Yeah, it's good to talk to you again. So yeah. I had to laugh because we were, you know, we talked before and we were about several days ahead of the election last time we talked. And now it's a little bit different. What are your thoughts about what happened?
Well, it is funny. I mean, not in a hilarious kind of way, but it is funny that, you know, the last time we talked, I think that we were both pretty sure that that Hillary Clinton was going to win. And at the end of the discussion, you even asked me to make a prediction, and I didn't. And I guess I'm kind of glad that I didn't. But anyway, you know, I spent 2 or 3 days in shock. Brad, my husband, and I, we laid in bed watching the returns come in, and I fell asleep around 11 o'clock, still sure, last I would wake up and Hillary would be president. And just for some reason, I woke up around 1:30, and that's about the same time that all the news stations were calling it for Donald Trump. And I don't think any of us were prepared. Hillary wasn't prepared. She hadn't even been in a concession speech. I think Donald Trump was prepared. He's been scrambling together. And, you know, America was prepared. It took a few days for it to sink.
Right. Yeah. We're having a little bit of connection problem there. You're breaking up a little bit. But it was, I actually had a heads up. Brody Levesque, who was on Out in Santa Cruz also, called me the night before and let me know that based on, he was very in touch with the people who were doing a lot of the statistical analysis and the modeling and all that. And so he had a heads up that it was not going our way. So I saw early on in the evening when things weren't happening, I signed off on Facebook and said, I can't watch, which sounded maybe to a lot of people a little premature negative, but it was what it was. So
nothing else.
Jason, I'm going to assume you called in on the other line here.
Yeah. I'm hoping that you can hear me a little better now.
Actually, that is a lot better. So I'm going to let you go.
Oh, excellent.
So
yeah,
great.
I'm actually in a hotel. Yeah. Okay. So, I would say that maybe premature isn't necessarily the wrong word, but, prescient may be the right word.
Right. So the one thing I wanted to ask you about, though, and switching over to Black Kettle, much of Black Kettle and the personas that are described in there have kind of this, it's a persistent theme with the tangents that you talk about throughout the book. But there is a persona of this entitled mindset by certain people in society, of certain groups in society, that they own society to the point of, the original fable behind Black Kettle, or not fable, the original historical account behind Black Kettle,
right.
Where, it was genocide, basically.
Yeah.
How do you see those themes that you were working with Black Kettle playing out now in our political system?
It's wild how closely the world today parallels that story and how closely we can draw those parallels to what's happening today. At the same time, this is the slaughter, the Sand Creek Massacre happened in the 1850s. So what's that, 175 years ago, 1860s. And, they were dealing with the same darkness in humanity, that we deal with today. So we spend a lot of time. Hello?
Yeah, we're still here. Sorry.
Okay.
We got
all sorts of
going off around this.
So we spend a lot of time, looking around us today, saying, oh gosh, it's never been this bad before. These are unprecedented times. Never before in America have we elected somebody like Donald Trump, or never has there been such bombastic rhetoric and hateful jargon, spread in the name of politics or in the name of humanity. And the reality is, as awful as it seems right now, it's not unprecedented.
Right.
The American way of life is built on, unfortunately, at least historically, the oppression of minorities who aren't strong enough to fight for themselves unless they organize in a forceful way, or get slaughtered as they did back then. So, some of my friends, some of my more conservative friends, are concerned that people are protesting against the American way, and they're protesting against Donald Trump. But if they are politically marginalized, and in this case, they lost an election, then what other sources of action do they have?
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Although
yeah.
I do think there, I agree with you. There is definitely precedent across the board. I mean, we look at, our vantage point really goes back to the 1950s. And, if it didn't happen in that time, it never happened, we kind of have a ledge there where history just sort of disappears, on all sides.
I might argue that ledge is closer to 1980.
Yeah,
at least in the circles that I run in.
When I hang out with millennials, maybe that's even more true. The 50s,
yeah,
50s
for sure,
is
for sure.
Now ancient history and off the ledge. But we do have some new things that have happened. It is ironic that the very first woman candidate for president ever. Who actually ran not in a primary, but as a party nominee for a major party, actually won the popular vote by a greater margin than many of the men presidents who actually got into office in the last
decades. Right, including her husband, right?
Right.
So what a momentous time. You know, and I think that's a great point. You know, how proud can we be as Americans that we have a Hillary Clinton among us, right? And that we nominated Hillary Clinton to be the leader of, you know, what is ostensibly, you know, and there, I may get some hate mail for this, the greatest nation on earth, right?
Right.
So I think that's wonderfully exciting. That is quite a milestone for we the people to have crossed
right.
over.
And a little bit ironic, you know, because I mean, for women, it's saying, you know, guess what, women, you can break the ceiling, you can run, you can actually win, and we will applaud your achievement. And the power? No, you don't get that. No. Are you kidding? No. No, you got to be a man to actually have the power, to get the power. I mean, it's truly the Electoral College, but, you know.
Another way of looking at that, though, is, hey, you know, Hillary, you have done the same thing that every other man that's run for president over the past 240 years that didn't win has done. Right. So in losing, she has also achieved a great thing. Right. Just the fact that she ran.
Well, yeah, it's true. But there have been men who've lost, who actually lost. I mean, who actually lost the popular vote.
You're talking about the popular vote. Yeah.
Right.
That's an interesting argument. It's an interesting discussion. You know, it's the system. She definitely had ran up the numbers in those places where she had very strong support.
Actually, looking over the whole landscape, I think, and this kind of goes back to the themes in Black Kettle, that, you know, a lot of the things in your book are where you're kind of riding along the plot, and it's sort of like going, you know, as expected, and all of a sudden, two sentences later, you're going, what? You know, it sort of pulls the veil off of a dark underside that you weren't expecting to be there. And I think that's sort of a parallel to what we were experiencing. This, you know, a lot of the things that Donald Trump represents and the white supremacy support he gets and all that didn't just get invented. That's been sitting there, you know, and brewing, especially because
it's been festering.
We had an African-American president. And and so what has really happened is the veil over something that we have really been living with has been revealed. And so now we get to move forward with the knowledge that it's there.
What another astute observation. And I love that you drew that parallel out of Black Kettle, because in Black Kettle, what seems to be, you know, exposing, you know, the dark underside is really just it's disclosing the other side. Right. And so we spend so much time. And it's not necessarily the dark side, unless you consider yourself standing in the light, which I guess most of us do. Right. So ultimately, you know, the project of Black Kettle is to open up discourse, right? And the biggest part of discourse is being exposed to other ideas, right? And so if we whether it's good ideas or bad ideas, right, if we don't know that they're there, we can't talk them out.
Right,
and so I think that's a big part of it. That's really what I want to do in Black Kettle.
Right. Although I have to say, you know, saying it's just the other side. It's, I don't know if I quite buy that. Like, you know, not to give anything away, but, you know, you're reading along and suddenly a certain character has killed his stepfather and then eaten him. I think that's a little more than just the other side.
It's It's but to your earlier point, it's the side of humanity that exists, right?
Right.
And it may be the most evil, but if we don't expose it, then we can't address it, right? And
right.
And so yes, that's probably an extreme example.
Which is exactly my point about the election. Exactly.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. Yeah. 100%. You know, the Republican Party, you know, for, you know, however we want to look at it now, right? But as somebody who, you know, full disclosure, I'm a lifelong Republican, right? I voted for Hillary Clinton. I was not a Trump supporter, but I'm a lifelong Republican. And my take has been that the Republican Party pushed those elements out of the Republican Party, right? And so it may, you know, on second review have been, you know, covered over. But I feel like what Donald Trump did is he brought back all of these people, all of this nastiness, all of this racism, all of this misogyny, all of this anti-everything sentiment that, you know, the Republican had really marginalized.
Right.
Yeah, at least in our rhetoric, we were saying, hey, you know, we want to be a big tent. We want to be open. A lot of the leadership had come around or were in the state of evolution on LGBT rights. And you know, we were losing elections because we had pushed out such a big part of what turned out to be our base. So it's
right.
really been a come to Jesus for the Republican Party. As this nasty scab has been pulled off and exposed, that we've got to really reassess and get rid of.
Right, right, yeah, scary. But let's go to the book though. Tell us, you know, because I know we did it on Santa Cruz, but for listeners who didn't hear that, and believe it or not, there are a few in the world. What is the premise or the backbone of Black Kettle and the tangents that you go throughout the book?
So there is an overarching story about a Native American Cheyenne chief named Black Kettle, and his story is really used as you use the word backbone. I think that's a good way of looking at it for all of the short stories that sit upon it. And basically, you know, in 3 minutes, the story of Black Kettle is he was a peaceful Cheyenne chief during the 1850s, which just happened to be the time when, you know, Manifest Destiny across the North American continent was driving Americans, white Americans, from east to west. And if you know anything about the geography of the country, you know, there's that great plains area where the buffalo roamed, and that was the natural home of the Cheyenne
right.
people. But that also happened to be in the way of the Americans moving west, and so the Americans kept saying, "Move to this smaller, you know, to this piece of land. Move to this piece of land, smaller and smaller, farther and farther away from the buffalo, farther and farther away from your natural land." And Black Kettle kept saying, okay, you know, we'll do it. We trust you. And, you know, he even went and met with Abraham Lincoln. I mean, this is he traveled all the way east, met with Abraham Lincoln, who at the time had his own troubles in the early 1860s. But Abraham Lincoln said, hey, you know what, Black Kettle, here's an American flag, and if the Americans continue to give you trouble, you raise this flag up over your teepee and we'll know, hey, these are peaceful folks. Well, there was I'll call it a rogue detachment the army out in based out of Denver, led by a Methodist preacher named John Chivington, and he basically wanted to make a name for himself, because if you are in the military in 1860 and you're not fighting in the Civil War, you need something to make a name for yourself, so you may as well go kill some Indians. So he attacked Black Kettle's village and basically massacred, you know, 90% of the folks there. Even though and this is the part that just rips your heart out. Even though Black Kettle raised up that American flag with the flag of truce over his teepee, and so this story kind of highlights one of the main themes, which is the failure of words. Right? We may have good intentions, but our words and our actions don't always match, and that was the case here with Abraham Lincoln. So I take that story, and then I slap it up against the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, right, in which, the biblical story, in which God's chosen people were saved, even as, God exacted revenge upon the wickedness of the world. And so these two stories, there's some ambivalence there, because I'm saying, we as Americans, are we the good guys, or are we the bad guys? Was Black Kettle really wicked in the eyes of God? And, the American people really were granted all of North America by God, as the rhetoric was in the 1850s. Or, was there something different at play? So, again, that whole idea of not really wanting to call out what I think is right and what I think is wrong, but to expose, the possibilities and open up a discourse about, how we can look at ourselves and how we can look at history.
Right. Well, and it's especially what happened, which is kind of ironic, because when you and I had this conversation a few weeks ago, it's almost like the end of the story didn't get told, that sort of frames the themes in your book to what is going on right now. It hadn't played out, but sort of the play out is this government now that is the legacy of that white manifest destiny mindset that is now on the defensive, saying, oh, these immigrants coming in and they have no right. And, it's sort of, accusing others of doing what, per your book, our legacy did itself. But then again, if you go back to that, the pure play manifest destiny, then that also could make sense in a warped sort of logic, because it's our land, it was meant to be our land, and it is meant to continue only to be our land. And so, we have every right of ripping it apart from the people who were here before, and we have every right to, vilify the people who want to follow our behavior, coming in.
Right.
Or actually left. Not because they're not looking to come in and massacre us to get in. They just want to join.
Right. Right. And, just to kind of, complete the loop on that, that story is also the story of Israel. Right. And if you want to take that story and say, well, how many times throughout history, throughout the history of mankind, not just the history of America, has this same story played out? And if we look at what's going on in that region of the world even today, we're still seeing the ramifications of that, the clash of those identities and those values and those morals. When we get to the point where we are justifying war or genocide or confiscation or the dehumanization of entire groups of people based on what we claim God wants, I think that's the real fear that I have.
Right.
Because, I also consider myself a Christian, and the Christian God that some people claim, to follow, even as they, spout hatred and seek to confiscate rights and power from other groups, is not the same God that I, as a Christian, I adhere to.
Right, and I'm
like
right
to think
there
of
with
God
you.
Of love.
Yeah. I'm right there with you, because that I also am Christian, and we're kind of looking at the storm gathering on the horizon, because that is coming. I mean, that has been by the Congress, the people who gained power, that is a commitment they've made that they are going to pass laws that allow quote unquote religious freedom. But, you know, under that is the principle under their, what they're calling religious freedom is the freedom to discriminate against basically you and I, you know, which I, to me is, you know, taking away from what is legal and right and moral, you know, in today's society, my interpretation of the scripture and, you know, Jesus's two commandments of, you know, love God above all else, and then, you know, love your neighbor as yourself.
Love your neighbor.
You know, that alone to me is the ultimate statement of equality. You know, it's it is very interesting, and you know, these themes, you know, for those who pick up this book, you know, I think they're going to be even more poignant and in your face in a very dramatic way than ever before. I mean, the timeliness couldn't be more on target, in my opinion.
I want
to shift gears, Jason, on some of the other aspects of the book. One is that you in the book you have a lot of fluidity between sexuality and gender identity, and one of the things that, you know, when we talked on out in Santa Cruz is FCC regulated, and you can't, you know, you have to have G-rated language. So on here, we gloves are off, you know, so we can be a little more upfront about things. But
PG.
The erotic descriptions and depictions in the book are, correct me if I'm wrong, but most of them were heterosexual in nature, where it got really graphic and everything else. And I was just kind of curious where that came from you as an author, you know, that was the ones that you felt inclined to be very descriptive of. Whereas there's definitely, you know, gay stories, or particularly one gay story, but it's kind of chaste in comparison.
Yeah. So, one reviewer who kind of panned the book, and I would, you know, I argue he didn't really get it. Was not so much that, you know, I described a lot of sex, a lot of gay sex, or a lot of homosexual, or, you know, straight sex, but that I seem to have an affinity for penises. that's okay to say, right? And so,
and who doesn't?
So maybe
go
I
ahead.
Think that's a yeah. It's, you know, just short of saying, you know, I have you know, I'm obsessed with a certain type of sex. You know, some people might read that as a pretty stark and clear gay man trait. And so even in those instances when I'm describing heterosexual sex, it's you know, generally from a guy's perspective, you know, and this is, it's kind of interesting because you know, when people were saying, oh, Jason, you know, if you want to write and you want to be, you know, really successful, you have to write, you know, have to find a niche. And I'm like, well, you know, I want my niche to be, you know, something literary. And they're like, oh, but if you could be, you know, a guy who writes romance novels from a guy's perspective, you know, nobody does that well. And and maybe that was in the back of my head because I do write.
Okay, so Jason, if this book is supposed to be that, I'm very, very scared. I don't think I would position Black Kettle as, okay, this is the guy's romance novel. It's like
right,
okay.
Yeah. I pretty consciously eschewed that, but the point is, yeah, the point is. That I write it, you know, from a male perspective, because
right.
I've never
right.
had sex as a woman.
Here's kind of the funny irony about all that, because you know, that review, like when I read the book, and you know, we were going to come on the radio on Out in Santa Cruz, you know, and your pre-press stuff didn't really spell out your sexual orientation. I mean, it really at all. And in fact, after I got through reading the book, was, you know, because of so much of the heterosexual graphic descriptions and everything else, and, you know, as if you were there, You know, it was like, you know, I'm not even sure if Jason's gay, you know, because, you know, it's like you definitely focused on that.
Right.
And I'm just wondering if that reviewer wasn't in some ways looking for it with the knowledge that you were gay. In other words, whether there might even be a little tinge of homophobia in his point of view.
You know what? I will take that as an excuse for the bad review.
You don't really have to answer that. You can sort of let that one sit out there. But I'll be the one who said it.
Yeah, fair enough. But you know, maybe you know, there. I think there is an expectation. You know, just as in you know the wider culture, that if you're black, you believe this, right? If you're gay, you have to believe this politically, right? If you are straight, then you know you will behave in this way. If you're gay, you know then we expect you know we have these expectations, and I don't think it's human, right? To if we're gonna put a label on ourselves to take those labels, you know, and carry them around with us, and you know, those of us who strive toward actualization want to shed those labels as much as possible and be treated and viewed as an individual. But you know, I think that's possible. They may have, you know, they said, well, you know, why is this gay guy writing about, you know, graphic sex with women?
Well, although I mean, it was completely fair to not have you as the author be part of it, to just take it as is. This, you know, this is what it was. And you know, in that story, I mean, certainly the character overshadowed it. I mean, I have to tell you, it's like that, especially that one story. It was so. I mean, I can't shake it. It's like it's. You know, I think about that story a lot. You know, it's disturbing, and the character in it is disturbing, and you know, it's.
Are you talking specifically about Caraway?
Actually, I was talking about Barb Rebarb.
Oh, Barb Rebarb. Okay, yeah. Oh, well, yeah, he was pretty awful.
Yeah.
oh yeah.
Oh, that one.
Oh, that
so
one.
So why don't you describe because you created a book that is creative in its own layout in how it's structured. Can you talk to that a little bit for people who are not familiar with it?
Yeah, totally. And I appreciate you asking that question because really, my first book, Momentitiousness, that came out in 2013, was written as a it was supposed to be my PhD dissertation. So for reasons beyond my control or within my control or whatever excuse I want to come up with, I didn't actually write a dissertation. Instead, I wrote this book. And the whole point of it was to introduce a new genre that's not quite novel, that's not quite short story, and it's a step beyond connected short story. What I really wanted to do was present a series of facts, right? Basically, the theory is, without going into a whole dissertation anyway, basically present a whole bunch of facts to people and then let people put those facts together based on their own life experience to tell their own story. So in the first book, Momentitiousness, I had 30 short stories and poems, and I said, you pick out three or four of them, put them together, and see what kind of story you can create. Some of us might remember, you know, back in the 80s, the Choose Your Own Adventure books. And so this was kind of that on a literary level, without a clear path that I prescribed. Because even the Choose Your Own Adventure books, you know, it's like if you choose this, then you know one of these two things is going to happen. But
right.
If you take that a step back and you say there's 30 times 29 times 28 times 27 times 26 different ways that this story can be told, and the only thread is you know, the reader, and how you put these, how you retell the story, and how you interpret it, and so it's never the same. And so what Black Kettle does is it kind of takes that, that theme, and in the same way says here are a whole bunch of stories, rather than collecting them into one book, I collected them into three what I call novellas. So they're I call them novellas connected, and each of those novellas is made up of different stories that can be read in any order, and you know, picked and plucked, and you know, given meaning by the reader. So yeah, that's kind of what Black Kettle does, a little bit differently from a traditional collection or novel itself.
Right. It's one of the few books that you'll pick up that in the front, it actually describes the different ways that you can read the book. You know, it tells you, you can do this, you can do this. And, you know, it sort of gives you the option to different experiences. There's been a term described to your writing style, semiotic arbitrage. Can you tell us what semiotic arbitrage means in relationship to what you just described?
Yeah. So semiotic arbitrage, it you know, when I mentioned this was supposed to be my dissertation, that was the topic of my dissertation. It's a critical method that I invented. And basically what it does is it says, there are ways that we, in the world of literature and linguistics, look at the world, and that's through signs. And words are signs, and signs are comprised of, you know, how we interpret a word and how we give meaning to a word. So, like, just for instance, when we say that, you know, when I say the word chair, and I say close your eyes and think of chair, do you think of the word? Do you see the letters, you know, in your mind, or do you picture a chair, you know, somebody sitting in a chair? And, you know, that interplay is kind of the idea of what semiotics is in the world of linguistics. And then arbitrage is a term out of economics that says that through trade and through nothing else, you know, independent of manufacturer or at the actual adding of value, we can derive profit. And so an example of arbitrage is like currency speculation. So I can buy, you know, five Canadian loonies with one American dollar, and then I can take those five loonies and buy 10 British pound. And then with those 10 British pound, I go back to America and I can get, you know, a different amount of dollars. And so through that set of trades, you can actually make money by doing nothing besides trading. And so semiotic arbitrage is taking the difference between the sign and the symbol, right? And that way that we picture the word chair as opposed to the thing, the chair. And then the interplay between those as trade and ultimately developing a cultural profit. And so this cultural profit is the space where, you know, new ideas are born. It's beauty. And so this is kind of where I get kind of, you know, I kind of get out there, but the way that applies to my writing is it says, you know, there is an interplay of ideas. There's an exchange of ideas between what I have written and what you as the, you know, consumer of that interprets, right? And so that's the difference between the sign and the symbol. And between what I intend and what you perceive, there's a space there for profit and new ideas. And every time you read a text, and, you know, this text especially, you're creating something new to take out into the world, some new piece of beauty, some new idea, some new way of looking at the world. And, you know, it's not earth-shattering. If we sit and we think about it, it's like, yeah, of course, that's why we read. That's why we read poetry. That's why we listen to music. But to do it and to have a word for it, a phrase for it, semiotic arbitrage, and to be able to consciously do it, it becomes an exercise. And if it becomes an exercise that we can all take part in together, then we're creating more profit and more beauty and more discourse and more, you know, opportunity to love in the world.
Right, right. So it's sort of characteristic of the semiotic piece of that. In the book Black Kettle, you have a story called, I think it's called Baptism.
Mm-hmm.
And but what transpires in baptism is not what you would normally, I mean, if you say the word baptism and say, okay, guess what this story is going to be about, it's not what you would normally just pop out as like, oh, I'm sure it's a story about this. How does that relate to what happened and the title of that story?
Well, so in a sense, the characters in Baptizer could be thought of as what probably first comes to mind, a John the Baptist and Jesus type character, right?
Right.
Both of whom are, you know, martyred for a greater cause, tragically for a greater cause, and in the face of you know, people that, you know, were supposed to love and protect them. And also, like the traditional story of baptism, you know, from the Bible, there is the conscious storytelling and myth making around that. So, you know, basically for those of us listening, the story is, you know, two young men meet for the first time in a gay bar before gay bars were a safe place to be. And some outsiders, riled up by political foment or whatever it may have been, attack the gay bar and ultimately, you know, attack these two young lovers who had only known each other for 15 or 20 minutes, but who had hit it off, you know, as people do, you know, when they're very lucky at a gay bar. And so you know, but the big theme there is really kind of looking at how the story is told and retold and how it takes on mythic value, because it's told through the eyes of the bar owner, who, you know, before this event happened, you know, he was just a merchant. He was just somebody who ran a bar and that was his job. But then he realized after this happened, after this major event occurred, and when now there were martyrs among him, you know, whose blood had stained the floor of his establishment, that he had a responsibility, you know, just as the apostles did in the New Testament after Jesus died, to spread the story and to give the story value and to you know, make these figures, you know, who really had only known each other for 15 or 20 minutes, into lovers, into more than they necessarily might have been in reality, so that he could make a point, a political point, a cultural point, a social point, to the rest of the world. So yeah, it's a pretty packed story.
Right. Oh, yeah.
in those ways.
So since you've written the book, and I'm sure you've had many, many discussions, not just with me, but with like other people.
Yours have been the best, though.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
So what, you know, as you've talked to different people and they've read the book, and I'm sure they have talked about the very poignant characters throughout the book, what character tends to get talked about the most?
As far as individual characters, I think that, you know, probably the characters from Baptizer, you know, get a lot of attention, even though, you know, we don't really get to know them, you know, so much
right.
as we get to know the myth around them. You kind of talked about the Barb Rebarb character, who is, you know, just absolutely atrocious. My favorite character, and I think the character that a lot of people are afraid to talk about, is the Caraway character. He's the star of the Nola trilogy, which is another pretty PG-13 rated story that kind of follows, you know, the hijinks of this fella as he goes out searching for an ex-girlfriend in New Orleans and you know, runs into all kinds of characters. But, you know, that character is really I think the most literary, or it has the most literary allusion behind it, because for those of us that remember 11th grade literature, 11th grade English, and that had to read Great Gatsby, they'll remember that Carraway was the he was the narrator, and
right.
he's famously thought of as, you know, the untrustable narrator. Like, we don't really know, you know, who he is or what part of that story of Gatsby was true and what part of that story of Gatsby wasn't true. So I kind of take that persona, that Carraway character, out of Gatsby, and I put him in a new situation where he's the star, and he again is telling a first person account of his night. And
right. And
so I think a lot of people are interested in him. And then I think another character that I also like and that I get a lot of comments about is the old man, for lack of a better word, from the story Tad. And that is a retelling of the story of Tomas Mann's A Death in Venice. And so he falls in love. You know, he's kind of an older man who has a fantasy in his mind about an adolescent that he sees and instantly falls in love with, but that never actually has an opportunity to talk to. So it's all of this imagined relationship that he has with this kid. It's just like Tomas Mann's story, pretty effed up.
But and I don't want to turn shrinkish on you or anything else, but where do you pull some of this stuff from yourself? I mean, is this venting like exercising out like the extremes of imagination, or where does that come from your organic writer that puts these out there?
Well, doctor. Dr. Freud, let me lay down here.
Hour, by the way.
So, one of the things that you hear again in 11th grade English is, you know, whatever you do, don't conflate the narrator of the story with the author of the story. And I call BS on that. Every single word that I write, or any author writes, or
right.
you know. Anybody, you know, writes, it comes out of their mind, right? And so to say, oh, well, you know, there's none of, you know, don't see the author in his words, you know, that's a fallacy. There's a lot of me and my experiences that just by the very nature of the fact that they're, you know, coming out of my mind through my hand, that they're part of me. Some of the characters, some of the experiences, you know, I've been in similar situations, and so I'm able to draw on those. I also have, you know, I read a lot, and I guess I have a pretty active imagination.
it's true, because, well, for example, when years ago, I wrote a play that had two very strong, completely diametrically opposed female characters that were, you know, they were kind of central to the plot of the play. And,
right.
you know, it looking back on that, both of those characters were my mother, both of them. They
uh-huh.
were like two sides
yeah.
of, you know, this woman that I knew extremely well, you know, sort of the side that was, you know, almost saintly and, you know, certainly a part of her. And then this kind of wilder, almost perverse other side to her. And then,
uh-huh.
you know, so when I wrote it, it's like sort of separated it out and put those two sides opposing themselves as different people.
Right. That's interesting.
So it just, you know, some of the extremes in the characters, although I, reading it, I didn't interpret it like, you know, gee, I can't wait to talk to Jason and find out, you know, it's like, you know, what he did last Saturday night, you know, based on this story. But I still see it this way is sort of what you're pulling out of people you see on more of the national landscape, which is why I'm dying to see you write a Trump-like character to find out what your take of the inner workings of that kind of mind is.
Yeah. So the character in Barbary Barb, the reality is I know that man. What's really funny is that when Donald Trump, announced his candidacy, for the nomination, I said to myself, oh my God, he's just like the character that I based Barbary Barb.
Or we could translate that as, oh my God, I wrote Donald Trump. But anyway.
I would never admit that, but I certainly see, when I think about all of the things that I despise about the real life human being that I patterned Barbary Barb after, a lot of the, cartoonish parts of that have been attributed to and can, probably be said about, the cartoon character Donald Trump.
Right. Right. So, ladies and gentlemen listening, we are going to wake up tomorrow morning. We're going to find out that Donald Trump, in fact, is not president. He was simply a character written by Jason LaClerc. And, he closes the book and he stays inside the book.
It's gone.
Right?
Poof.
So, yeah, although Hillary Clinton certainly could be a character in herself. I mean, she is a unique, persona. That and if you wanted to write in dark sides around her, I'm sure that could be done as well. But
I think that I would be overwhelmed to try and capture Hillary Clinton. I think that she is such a rich character. Whereas I said earlier, Donald Trump is almost a cartoon. He's easy to write.
Right,
but to really get into the mind of somebody as brilliant and as accomplished and as complex and probably troubled and human as Hillary Clinton would really be a challenge. I'm not sure that I would feel up to it, to be honest. I'll leave that to John Meacham.
I think it would be somewhat fascinating because it's to your point, it's like she's complex and it's. If you follow any track of her story individually, they kind of are very disjointed. I mean, if you follow her political career, she was, ensconced in the executive branches, both in Arkansas and in the United States. Even as First Lady, she was active in the administration. She went to the Senate. Then she went to the State Department, amassing this political resume that is really unmatched. Then if you shift from that to her personal life, to this woman with an ambitious husband who cheated on her public humiliation of being cheated on, staying with her marriage, then being vilified for doing that, for
being cheated on, right?
I mean, that's sort of the bizarre thing about what Donald Trump tried to pull and shaming her. It's just, and then you weave all that together as one person. That's that's pretty intense. So.
I call myself the poet economist. I'm not the poet historian. Necessarily. And, she deserves a rich and poetic, retelling of the actual life. I would, I would be out of my league to try and capture that.
Well, I think you're pretty in your league in terms of sort of a broader swipe of values and perceptions and humanity. I mean, that, come across in Black Kettle. I think too, believe it or not, we're almost out of time. But yes, I know. It's like you spent 2 hours with me, Jason, over the course of these two radio shows. But Black Kettle is you mean it sort of as a blank slate, correct? Within the person, is that fair? A fair estimation of the Black Kettle?
Yeah. So you know, there's a we talk about or have talked about the idea of the tabula rasa, as opposed to the original sin, right? And so, you know, as we look at others and we say, you know, what is it in you that that you should be ashamed of or be proud of? You know, in that whole phrase, the pot calling the kettle black, right? Inherent in that is judgment. And, you know, none of us have a, none of us are without sin, you know, and for somebody to look at an other, any kind of an other type of person, somebody outside of themselves, and to judge them, even as they themselves are not without sin,
right.
it's hypocrisy, and you know, we can approach people as if they are lily white, right, but really, in reality, we're all black, right? We're all covered with the soot of life. We all carry around within our vessel all of our experiences. And just like that black kettle, like the literal, you know, the cauldron, a black kettle that you cook soup in or you cook food in or you you put together magical spells if you know you wanted to go that far. The skin of that vessel takes on those characteristics. So on the inside and on the outside, we're all black with the with experience, regardless of whether you think that we started out, you know, lily white, or with some type of original sin.
Right, right. And so now, where can people get the book? And they must go get it. If you didn't get it from the last radio show, folks, you must get it now. So,
yeah. So the easiest way is to go to Amazon and look up Black Kettle, Jason LeClaire. Just do a search. You can get it on Kindle, hard copy, soft copy. However you love to read, we can provide it for you. If you want a signed copy and an inscribed copy, you can go to my website. Blackkettle.co, blackkettle.co. Interesting story. When I announced the name of the new book, somebody went out and bought blackkettle.com and then tried to sell it to me for $10,000.
Wow. Talk about black kettling. Oh my gosh. Yeah.
Right.
Well, Jason, thank you.
You can get it.
Yeah. Thank you so much for joining me yet again. Fascinating hour and really, really appreciate it. And folks, go buy Jason's book. I'm going to take us out with Guess What? It Is Christmas Time by Garrett Miller, which you can find on GarrettMiller.com. I hope you have a great evening and listen to us again next week.
Thanks, man.
Christmas with the sunshine in the trees. You might not even think of Santa Claus with his dogs down by the beach. Oh, their tails they are all wagging, wagging here to there. And the joyous sounds of barking without care. Your winter clothes. You might want a tiny puppy or one with a big brown